Okay, Michael, so let's continue here. You got some more fascinating information or facts between the Chaldeans of Ireland and the early Christian movements.
That's right. There's another very interesting quote here from a guy called Reverend Alexander Lowe. He wrote a book in 1826 called The History of Scotland from the Earliest Period to the Middle of the 9th Century, and he says that the Chaldee establishment had now acquired a firm footing in the nation. So we're talking about, this. They're dating all of this again from the birth of Christianity. So let's understand that most Orthodox writers, like we're quoting from, are only going to date this rising of the Chaldee tradition, you see, from the official dates of Christianity. Mm-hmm. They're not going to break ranks. They're going to believe what they've read. They're going to believe what they've learned in colleges, and schools. But we have to lay that. You can't present an alternative history unless you already know what the regular history is.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's why it's important to go through this.
Right.
And he says that the Chaldee establishment had now acquired a firm footing in the nation. Some of its members not only excelled in astronomy, poetry, and rhetoric, but also in philosophy, mathematics, and several other arts and sciences, which exactly correlates with the learned Druid Magi. Remember I said they had 400 years or more to do it? This is the quote that emphasizes what I was talking about. You don't do it overnight. You can't learn astronomy overnight, well, especially the esoteric form that was being taught in Druidism.
A lot of knowledge here to accumulate.
That's right. And you got an agenda. You're not sweating in these monasteries and these scriptoriums because you're dying to help mankind. You're dying to dominate mankind. You are looking for a new world order. You're looking for the world is not enough. You are the descendants of people who were thrown out of the greatest empire in the world. Now you want the whole world to be, as I show in the book, your plaything. You are now wanting to replace the thrones of Egypt with domination over the whole world.
So they got this idea that, the only way to do this is through the knowledge, absorb all of this, and first and foremost, go to the root of the knowledge.
Right. Go to the wellspring.
Yeah.
And as everyone knows today, if you didn't have those ugly cities that cover England and Ireland, imagine they're not there. Ireland and England is a garden paradise. It was called Albion, Avalon. Yeah. You couldn't imagine a more garden paradise. So these characters, when they get there, they're not only returning to the wellspring from which all of this knowledge comes, they're now going to have to sit quietly in remote areas, siphon through all the knowledge, plagiarize it as much as they can, create a new archive, give it a new shell, which we know as Judeo-Christianity, and use this to beat to death the rest of the world. Because they're not Amonists. They're not going to allow you to worship as you want to worship. They're going to dominate you with their own solar theology. So he goes on to say, this is incredible, it's worth reading again. He says the Chaldee establishment had now established a firm footing in the nation. Not to save you, not to educate you, not to feed you, right? But to dominate you. Some of its members, he says, not only excelled in astronomy, poetry, and rhetoric, but also in philosophy, mathematics, and several other arts and sciences. And he admits, which exactly correlates, he says, with the learned Druid Magi. It is among the Scottish Chaldees that we are to look for that pure pattern of Christian life, such as was exemplified in the African, Greek, and Egyptian anchorites. Anchorites means renunciates. The early Christians who lived in the deserts, who beat themselves with stones and, like St. Jerome, anchorite is like a hermit.
Okay.
And there's an old tradition of the early, St. Jerome, for instance, was an anchorite.
Okay.
We can put up a link for people to explain what that was and how preposterous and weird the early Christianity was. Some of them, ties in with my work on sadism and self-sadism and all this stuff. Utterly crazy things that were going on. But he is saying we need to look to this British version of Chaldean Christianity. So it's not just a Michael Tassarian theory here. There's official, centuries ago, this was written up in the great histories of Scotland.
Very interesting.
Barry Dunford, again, in his Holy Land of Scotland, says, it was in the far reaches of Glen Leon, north of Loch Leon, where, in effect, the first Christian church was apparently established. Again, it's not going to mean much to people listening, but if you're Scot, this will mean a lot.
Right.
If you're thinking of taking a package holiday over there, Scotland, why not go up there to Glen Leon and, look at all of this stuff. What I want to point out is look at the word Glen Leon. Glen is field, Leon is lion. What is the cardinal symbol of the Atonists? Anybody who's read my work and followed my stuff knows that the single most important symbol of the Atonists is the lion.
The lion, yeah.
And it's the all-pervasive state symbol that you see on the great flags of England now.
Mm, right? Yeah, yeah.
We'll get all to that later, what that means, right? But this royal standard that's on state buildings, at Trafalgar Square, you know, MGM.
Sure.
Again, the solar lion is the symbol of the Atenists.
Yeah.
One of the most earliest monasteries, their earliest castles, their earliest territories in Scotland, of all the names you could pick, right? Just happens to be at the Field of the Lion, the place of the Lion, Glen Leon. I don't think there's a coincidence.
No, no.
Dunford goes on to say that according to ancient Welsh manuscripts, it was in southern Wales that at a place called Llanwit Major that a Christian seat of learning was established during the first century AD under the supervision of a certain person called Ilid. Right? So Ilid.
Mm.
An Israelite. Dunford's calling him an Israelite. Probably or possibly an Essene.
Mm. All right.
Yeah. Who, in fact, was said to have been none other than Joseph of Arimathea. So he's saying that this Ilid is Joseph of Arimathea, who is an Essene.
Okay.
Now he's endorsing the East to West movement here, which is right. Yes, these people did move from the West, from the East to the West, and members of the royal family of Bran the Blessed, particularly his granddaughter, Princess Urgain, there's Urgain again, whose father, Caractacus, had spent several years in Rome at the same time as the Petrine Church. Right, that's Peter, St. Peter.
Okay.
Rome's named after St. Peter, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, look what we're being told here. Isn't that a coincidence? That the supreme king of England and Scotland and Wales, he's born in Wales, Caractacus, and his clan, his daughter, Urgain, are hobnobbing in Rome at exactly the same time as St. Peter is preaching there.
Mm.
Whether or not you believe there ever was a St. Peter is a whole other question, but let's just go with what they're saying for now.
Sure, sure.
He's saying at the same time as the Petrine Church was being established there. It should be remembered that Urgain and Claudia, that's her sister, were both granddaughters of the sister of King Metellanus at Fortingall.
Mm.
Fortingall is near this Loch Leon.
Okay.
It's one of the Menzies strongholds, okay?
All right.
But look at the word Fortingall. Fort is obvious. It means what it means today, which is fort or castle.
Sure.
And Gall.
Gall, yeah.
The Gaels.
Hmm.
The Gaels are the Milesians, the Milesians are the Atenists, or the Scythians, etc., or the proto-Christians. So this is what we have to tie up for people who've studied a bit of Irish history and Scottish history and know about this. Oh, yes, we understand that it was a Culdee church. Oh, yes, like Alan Butler and Stephen Defoe have discovered, like we mentioned on a previous show, that these guys are identical to the Cistercian order.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's Irish monks, isn't it, who formed the Cistercian order that they had monasteries all over the world, the richest and most successful monasteries all over the world. They are the monkish wing of who?
The Knights Templar. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
They're not just teachers of the Knights Templar. They are the Knights Templar.
Mm.
There's not even a division. These same families have two wings. They love doing everything with a dialectic.
Hmm.
Just like you've got Protestant and Catholicism today, or you've got Christianity and Mohammedanism or whatever, you know, all created from the Vatican. I mean, the proof is right there. Well, it's no different in these early days when they're creating these divisions of the monkish side. That's job is to plagiarize the physical knowledge of the Druids, the spiritual knowledge of the Druids, I mean. And you have the military wing, you see, who will act should you need it to spread the word, to dominate, to control, to destroy rivals. They got bloody rivals. They got plenty of rivals. You need an armed gang. You're going to tell us in history books they were wonderful keepers of the highways. They were wonderful protectors of the pilgrims. Fact is, no, they were butchers who mass murdered their way across Europe, killing all their rivals.
Hmm.
Business as usual.
Hmm.
Roman Empire's the same. Not that every Roman Caesar bought into this, of course.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. We can talk about that a little bit. Well, there were some Caesars against this, I guess.
Yeah, particularly Diocletian. And his Caesar. Diocletian was an Augustus, which means an emperor, a very senior emperor. And his sidekick, whose name I can't quite remember now, Gelidus or something, we'll put up a link.
Mm-hmm.
They were very much anti-Christian.
Mm.
They saw through all this lie, I believe. And in fact, Diocletian is a very, very famous and extremely enigmatic Caesar or emperor, whatever you want to call him.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's always been a very important figure in Roman, you know, history. But is hated by Christians, of course, but I think that he and his colleagues wanted to go back to the old pantheistic, you know, worship of many gods, and were absolutely upset and highly disturbed with this Christian thing going on, mm-hmm. and so they went around, you know, trying to suppress
it. So a little bit back again to the Ammonist ideology there.
I would say so, yeah. In my reading of it, absolutely. He's a guy who suddenly realized these guys are corrupt as hell.
Mm.
I'm trying to restore the empire, and we can't do it with these characters running around. So he's put the sword on them, you see.
Mm.
This is one of these uprisings. So let's not, you know, when we're talking about Rome, we're not talking about all families being in cahoots.
Exactly. There's always some infighting going on and bickering. And
yeah. I believe the Atenists had friends, but they were people in high positions of power. Mm-hmm. It wasn't all of Rome. It wasn't all the families. It was like some specific families who had idealized Akhenaten, you see, who looked at him as the sun king of the world,
mm-hmm.
you know, who looked at him as a legitimate messiah. And these are the people who would have become...
But probably through some kind of secret societies of the day or some
that's
order,
right.
that's how
yes.
they disseminated the info and basically told everyone what the agenda was and where they were going with this, I guess.
Oh, yeah. No doubt in my mind that they all were in collusion. You know, but it's, you have to win converts. And anyway, Dunford goes on to talk about that here we have Princess Eugaine and her father Caractacus, who had spent several years in Rome at the time that the Petrine, that's the St. Peter's Church, was being established there. It would be remembered that Eugaine and Claudia were both granddaughters of King Metellanus at Fortingall. All right, so we're not talking about down the line, a couple of centuries later, a couple of decades. We're talking about at the moment of the rise of Rome.
Hmm.
The British, Atenistic, Milesian, Scythian, right? Families are right there
up
on the
and
spot.
At it. Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Can we then say they play more than a role as just bystanders? So the Reverend John Williams, he says, in a book called The Ecclesiastical Antiquities of the Cymry, or the Cymry, that's the Welsh, or the Ancient British Church, a book he wrote in 1844, he says, the missionaries who introduced the Christian faith into Britain were Ilid, right, Sindav, Mawan, and a character called, I have to get this right, Arwistli Hen.
Mm-hmm.
These are, you know, Welsh names.
Sure.
Arwistli Hen. Now, this Arwistli was none other than the Aristobulus mentioned by the apostle in the Epistle to the Romans.
Okay. Okay.
So here what we're talking about is another person who introduces Christianity, one of these families in England, is actually mentioned in the Bible, in St. Paul's Epistle to the Romans.
Okay.
Huh. Be that as it may, it is expressly stated that this Aristobulus, you know, under a different name, of course, Aristobulus was consecrated Bishop of Britain by St. Paul himself, and that he established churches and ordained presbyters and deacons in the islands. Okay?
Hmm.
So there's another deep connection.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing remote about this at all. Then a writer called George F. Jowett, who wrote a book called The Drama of the Lost Disciples, he says something amazing. He says that it is interesting to note that the Bethany group who landed in Britain, and the Bethany group is the bloodline group of Jesus, Mary Magdalene.
Uh-huh, okay.
They call them the Bethany group,
okay.
Mm-hmm. who may have survived the crucifixion. And then are rumored, you see, in British Israelite philosophy particularly, to come to England. And many Christians have no problem accepting this. But he says, it is interesting to note that the Bethany group who landed in Britain was never referred to by the British priesthood as Christians.
Okay.
Nor even later when that name was in common usage. They were called Chaldees.
Really?
Right? As were the other disciples who later followed Joseph of Arimathea's mission to Britain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what are they telling us here? That these guys form Christianity, but they're not even referred to as Christians. They're referred to as the Chaldeans.
Chaldeans, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're trying to, you know, they were specified in their own time. They were specified in their own time.
Mm-hmm.
So this early church is being formulated gradually. Now, here's the thing. You've just conquered the Western Isles. But you can't really run an empire from there because it's too far west. You'd lose control. So is it really not predictable that these characters would set up their epicenter, their administrative center, closer to the markets, so to speak?
Mm-hmm.
There's a good thing with a corporation here.
Sure, right? Sure.
These Chaldees. They don't mind languishing in the Garden of Eden, right, over there in Ireland, and they're loving it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can't run an empire from there because you're too remote. So they have their henchmen, their lieutenants, run what we now know as Judeo-Christianity, rising in Rome. They're guests of St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
St. Paul is guests of them. The tradition says that St. Paul came and visited. St. Peter, Simon the Zealots, right? Mm-hmm. Barnabas.
Mm-hmm.
The list goes on of the characters in the Bible who are known to have visited Britain.
Really? Yeah.
That's right. Did you know that in Rome there was a place called the Temple of the British?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. again, you can't understand world history until you get a grasp of this, that this Caractacus, and he's not the only one, many kings, because remember, under Roman rule,
mm-hmm.
which just slightly preceded the Christian rule, when the Romans took over, yeah, they had a lot of resistance, but they also then finally did conquer, and they had a lot of puppet kings,
mm-hmm.
kings who said, okay, we'll rule in the Roman name. Well, if you sided with the Romans and you took their, you know, coin, as it were, or you started to rule in place of the Caesars, you were then a dignitary. You were, you know, welcome in Rome.
Mm.
The British had their own temple.
The temple of the British Rome.
The temple of the British in Rome. And this is a most important anecdote to understand of what went on there.
Mm.
And I believe it was a center of Atenism. I absolutely believe that this is where the entertainment went on. Do you know that St. Paul was entertained there?
No idea.
St. Paul was actually a very close relative of another guy who's mentioned in the Bible is a centurion of Rome called Rufus Pudens.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm. Right? Mm. Rufus Pudens married Claudia of this Atenist families of England.
Hmm, so...
Urgain's sister.
And this doesn't, you know, come out of the blue, marriages like this. This is to merge the different power centers?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yes, and the proof of that revolves around a very important king also in Scotland called King Methlanus. And Barry Dunford, he writes about this. He says that the ancient Scots chronicles, this is again an old manuscript, record that when King Methlanus died in AD 35, his successor was this nephew of his, Caractacus.
Mm-hmm.
You see, this very famous king. And that the sister of King Methlanus was the mother of Caractacus. Caractacus's daughter, Urgain, remember we talked about her? She was one of the people who opened the first monasteries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whose grandmother was the sister of King Methlanus of Fortingall, is believed to have been a prime influence in introducing the Christian teachings into Britain. Her sister Claudia married a Roman centurion by the name of Rufus Pudens, who was purportedly banished to Scotland for his Christianity, where he preached earnestly the faith. St. Paul in Romans 16:13 refers to Rufus Pudens as chosen of the Lord.
Hmm.
Moreover, according to the contemporary Roman historian Dio Cassius, Caractacus was also related to the British Queen Boadicea. So now we got Caractacus, we got Boadicea, we got Methlanus.
Hmm.
The Scots know these are very, very, very important figures. Welsh know these people as well. This is key figures in early Christian history and in the in British history. There's the St. Paul tie-in.
Mm-hmm.
The centurion of Rome is married to a senior princess of the British royal line.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're all hanging up there at the palace of the British and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Barry Dunford goes on to say that the Scots Chronicle also record that Methlanus, a wealthy king, was on very good terms with the government of Rome at that time.
Mm.
And then the St. Paul connection, he talks about it. He says that the coming of St. Paul to the British Isles, and as the historian Eusebius mentions, to the utmost corners of the West, is owned on all hands to have been after the fourth year of Emperor Nero, at which time he was set at liberty in Rome. So they're saying that first Paul was under guard, remember, they claim he was arrested.
Right.
And then he's suddenly set free, you know, if we believe all this rubbish. And then he heads to England. Being to make his journey westward, it is not unlikely that he was influenced and engaged by that noble British lady, Claudia Rufins. Oh, so Paul is so on good terms with her that she's influencing him to go spend time with her folks.
Hmm.
Right, this is the official line.
Mm-hmm.
His convert, she's his convert, at whose house he was entertained to proceed directly to Britain, to her countrymen and relations, to preach unto them the word of life. It is supposed that St. Paul came to Britain sometime before Suetonius Paulinus. He's a very important historian.
Mm-hmm.
All major researchers into Celtic mythology and Irish mythology use his book.
Okay.
He was like a Marco Polo type of character.
Okay.
Who was one of the first people to come and write on the Druids. This guy is telling you, look, before he even set foot on Ireland, this gang was going on. The Atenists were already well in.
Sure.
The Rufins, people, and Claudia and all were doing their bit.
Mm.
There's an amazing quote from Henry Cairns Lawler in a book called Ulster, It's Archaeology and Antiquities. This book was written in 1928. He says, On some Irish megalithic monuments are to be found carvings of curious design and hieroglyphics, the key to the interpretation of which has not been discovered.
Mm-hmm.
The word hieroglyphic is derived from the two Greek words meaning sacred carving. Perhaps the most notable thing about these carvings is the resemblance of the designs to similar carvings and designs on stones, coins, pottery, and seals found in the countries adjoining the eastern Mediterranean, especially Crete, Cyprus, and Egypt. This goes so far to confirm the fact of the early Bronze Age traffic between these far-off countries and our own. In some instances, the symbols resemble those found in Eastern Mediterranean or in Egyptian inscriptions, whose meanings we know. For instance, in the right hand or upper Nachmani stone, this is in Ireland, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the top left-hand corner are several parallel wavy lines. This is a slight variation of the Egyptian hieroglyphic meaning the waves of the sea.
Mm.
A circle with radial lines spreading out occurs on several Irish stones. A circle with radial lines.
Mm.
Where do you see that? The symbol of the Aten, remember?
Hmm.
Aten sun disc with the radiating lines.
Oh, okay. Now I see what you mean. Okay, yeah, okay. Definitely.
On an Irish stone, he says that a circle with radial lines spreading out occurs on several Irish stones and is found in the tomb of Akhenaten in Egypt.
There we go. Yeah.
The king Akhenaten introduced sun worship into Egypt, and the design, that's actually not true, but you know we understand what he means here, and the design is by some supposed to represent the sun or the chief god worshipped by the early Bronze Age visitors to Ireland.
Hmm.
There it is. But these facts have never been brought to light to be shown exactly how powerful it is to understand that not just it influences Christianity, that Atenism is responsible for the rise of Christianity, that its birthing place is not Rome but Ireland, but that the Cistercian monks, you know, the Benedictines, you're talking about Chaldeanism here, and you're talking about Knights Templar and these secret societies, the Lodges of Initiation, the Lodges of Scotland, that are very, very powerful. The ceding of the land to all of these people is crucially important.
Michael, you mentioned the Sinclairs as an important family, but you also mentioned the Menzies during this era to be an equally important family.
Yeah, noble family, the Menzies is crucial. There's many of these families. We know about the Sinclairs because they've come to light as being a Templar family. They own most of Scotland. And they're part of the Roslin, you know, idea. The Roslin falls under the heading of what we're saying, a so-called Christian temple that seems to have so many pagan symbols on it.
Yeah.
You know, what's that all about, right? Well, Barry Dunford has an interesting thing to say on them. He says that the 19th century writer, W.F.C. Wigston, he's a Masonic writer, refers to Roslin Chapel as a Masonic temple, the cradle of Scottish Masonry, if not something deeper still. Let's read that again. He says that this is a Masonic temple, the cradle of Scotch masonry. That's heavy enough. And then he goes on to say, if not something deeper still.
What do you think he means by that?
Atenism.
Hmm.
That these Masons are the keepers of this knowledge. These Templars, these Cistercians, of course they know what's deeper still.
Hmm.
Deeper than the Orthodox understanding that the other Christians have.
Hmm.
We are familiar now, aren't we, that it's coming to light. I hope everyone understands this, that Christianity has basically got two traditions.
Hmm.
You know, since the work of the Gnostic Gospels, Alain Pagels, since the time of Bajent and Ley and the Bloodline, and now the Da Vinci Code, which is technically fiction, right? I mean, it must be, people must have grasped this fact now that even within Christianity, there's what's known as an exoteric and an esoteric tradition.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This is of their own making. They're putting this in front of you as if it's a rivalry. It's not, it's a game.
Mm.
It's a fake rivalry. They are desperate to cover up the destruction that they've done to the ancient Druids and to many other groups of people as well. So when these sort of paganistic images turn up, like the design of Roslin and so many other things, the robes that the Pope wears, you know, the design of Rome. I mean, you know, we've talked about this on so many other shows.
Sure.
When
sure.
all of this ancient world, Amanistic and Atenistic and Irish, Celtic and what, all of this Scythian and Chaldean imagery and Babylonian, the Sumerian imagery, is turning up in Christianity, they have to account for it.
Mm, yeah.
But they don't account for it by telling you, well, don't you understand? That's from all the people we put in the grave. We stole all that. They can't admit that.
No, no.
Criminals cover their tracks. When you get them into court, they have an incredible story. They have the amazing ability to tell you the most amazing lies. Well, this lie is to say, well, no, I guess what we have to admit then is this. There's two traditions within Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
There's this Mary Magdalene, hidden bloodline, grail, underground, you know, technically Christian. And then there's Vatican and these guys. So then they want you to now side with one or the other
side. Yeah.
And which is what they're really doing subtly to the whole of mankind now. That's why they put out these movies like The Da Vinci Code. That's why they're mulling over the idea as whether they're going to exonerate the Knights Templars. Tomorrow, the Grand Master is going to be an Oprah Winfrey telling all. I mean, we're going to, in the end, up have something amazing happening to us in the next lot of years, where they're going to really continue exonerating these people. So instead of being seen as the arch criminals they are, they're now going to be put before us as the secret keepers. The of keepers of the secret wisdom, just like that last shot in the Da Vinci Code, where they're all standing in Rosslyn and their tweed, the great enlightened ones who are just hard-pressed by the maniac Cyrus, you see?
Sure.
And these lunatic, bug-eyed monsters of the Vatican. What lies? This whole thing has been created to make you just, you know, continue with like a pendulum between one or the other. You're either orthodox and evangelist and down with all of those weird...
As we mentioned before... It's almost like a reformation in a new era and a new, you know, mystical background on this whole story is coming to light now.
That's right. And maybe, you know, we'll get to do a show on why this is happening. You know, it's a very important reason as to why this dialectic is being done. Why so many Masonic writers from within the system are coming out to write books, so-called whistleblowing. Why so many other critics are now telling you that there's nothing to fear from any of these, you know, secret societies. They're just brothers of mankind and all of this. You know, there's a reason why this is all happening. But anyway.
So I just want to squeeze in that question or comment there that so for those who are looking for a certain amount of traces from either previous civilizations or cultures or religions or ideologies actually can find some of that in what is being revealed now through the Templars.
That's right. They're going to offer you a lot. They're going to offer you a lot of things that they're going to say comes from their tradition. But they're going to, you know, pretty much disguise the origins of it all. They're not anxious for you to know the true story.
Sure.
But yes, the Menzies is a very important group. Barry Dunford talks about them. He says it has also been recorded in the Scots Chronicles that during the 2nd century BC, certain philosophers were able to inform the then Caledonian royalty as to the whereabouts of rich deposits of minerals beneath the surface of the land.
Oh, yeah, this is important, right. This part here, yeah.
Remember we said about the Boer War and the whole might of the British army is sent down there to unsettle the Boers,
sure.
The Dutch, to get at the gold. See, it's like this. The Romans come and put people to the sword and basically destroy the heart, the purest blood of the Druids. For 400 years before that, we've had Atonistic people operating in a context of Ireland, doing the same thing. Converting Druidism, you know, learning and weakening the roots of Druidism. Then we have the Romans, then we have the rising of Christianity. But the thing is this, that these famous families like the Sinclairs and the Menzies, these are royal families who are interested in mining. In fact, it's a very interesting study that people who want to check into any of this can go and look at it, that all the lands of these families that we're talking about just happen to be on the richest mining, you know, places where the ore of copper and metal is the most. In fact, King Metalanus gets his name from metal.
Obviously.
The king of metal.
Yeah, when you think about it.
They were international merchants in metal. It always comes down to big business, like Jordan Maxwell has said before.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, you're living in Ireland and England now, right? These bishops, you know, the early bishops of Rome that these people seated. Did you know that one of the families of the Menzies was like the first bishop in Lorraine in France?
Oh, yeah, tell us about that. That's
the Templar connection. We can get into that, you know.
Wow.
So these are an international mercantile group. But the downside of that is if you're merchants only, you're a nobility, you don't have the right, the people, the indigenous people, are not probably likely to let you go and build right on top of the ancient sites.
No, obviously not.
You know, which are Druidic. That's their religion. But you can do it if you invent a religion. So in the 400 years that they're sitting on Ireland and have now finished absorbing all the Druidic knowledge, they still get the problem of all the Druidic traditions are right there in plain view. And you can't go and start building on it or digging mines there because that's unacceptable. It won't happen. But the only way you can do it is if you create another religion that you have enough Druidic elements to say, oh, but we've created a religion that's the follow-on from Druidism. It's the perfect logical move
next
on.
Next step.
Right,
yeah.
And you've killed off everybody who would deny you
criticize
this or
that,
criticize
true.
It. And you then transplant it to the East so that it appears that it's coming from the East. So the rising of Christianity is an ideological warfare. So that these families could get hold of the land and put the churches and buildings on it. Like we said earlier, they were in mass. These churches and these monasteries were put on the Druidic sites. That happened because they're religious sites. You had to create a religion to do it, and that was the plan that I believe took them a couple of hundred years to work out.
So we have three things here that is happening. First, they get in there, and they manage to eradicate the druids, and they manage to get the resources out from the area, and they also manage to cover up the original, where the ideology came from day one, basically.
They do exactly what Akhenaten was trying to do in Egypt, which was destroy Ammonism. And if you read in my book, the utter tyranny that he did, the desecration of the temples, you see, the forbidding the priests to practice, the rape of Egypt during the 18th dynasty. They picked up business as usual when they finally get over to Ireland. And also Ireland and England is a much smaller place to conquer.
Oh, yeah.
It's simply easier. Plus, it's you feel better because you're in the land of the ancestors. You got a lot to win. You can really squeeze this tube. Yeah? But the thing is that, again, the people live there. Ordinary indigenous people live there who've been there for thousands and thousands of years before you came. They're not going to like these, what they consider utterly sacred places. Sure. These are very sacred places, the places of the druids. They're dedicated to the goddess. You don't go near them. How do you eradicate those places? You eradicate them by slowly inventing a new religion that in its early incarnation appears to be very similar. Remember in one of the quotes we said that they thought that the Essenes, Joseph of Arimathea, was an Essene? The word Essene, Henrik, comes from the old Gaelic, pre-Gaelic, from the old god Essa.
Essa.
Which was the earliest sun god of the ancient druids, the ancient druids. Jesus is a later version of this. Maybe we can get to that in a minute. But this is what they were doing. They were plagiarizing the old traditions. The Essenes wore white just like the druids. In fact, I would say that the Druids, the Chaldees, and the Essenes are the closest linked.
Really?
If people want to look for similarities between all these weird cults, it's through the Druids, the Essenes, and the Chaldees that you find the thread.
Interesting. Okay.
But getting back to this thing about the Menzies, it's very interesting. There's a quote by Barry Dunford. He says that this is confirmed by D.P. Menzies in his clan history. Right. So this is one of the Menzies who wrote a book on his own clan in 1894. He says, this genealogical family researcher claims that King Metellanus was descended from a guy called Menas, from whence is derived the name of Clan Menzies, who was the son of Fergus, the first king of the Scots. Again, apologies to anyone who's not interested in this, but the Scots will, have a handle on some of this, hopefully.
Sure.
Fergus, the first king of the Scots, who, according to the ancient Scots chronicles, originally came from Ireland to Scotland in 330 BC. Now, this D.P. Menzies remarks, Metellanus is said to have succeeded to the kingly office at about B.C. 13. So 13 B.C., this character called Metellanus becomes king of Scotland. Tradition says that he has held his court at Fortingall. Remember that famous Fortingall?
Yeah.
And by the way, I don't know if you know this, but the oldest tree in the world is at Fortingall.
Yeah, I think we talked about that.
It's
actually
a yew tree. Remember we talked about the importance of the yew trees and that they were even found in the Egypt is being worshipped, and that the yew tree, again, lots of Christian sites are right near yew trees.
Sure.
Well, again, this is the supplanting of the Druidic knowledge. And just as a case in point, that Fortingall is the oldest tree in Europe or the world.
Sheesh.
Now, in the country of the Menzies, and their old castle there is called Garth Castle, is thought to have been one of his old strengths. He is also the Menzies who is pointed out as the one who induced his kinsmen to study the arts of metal mining. Indeed, one of the forms of Gaelic of his name, Menzies, is mine. Klaus Mine, right? The name German, mine, mina.
Sure.
Which means metal or gold metal.
Mm.
Or mean, like M-E-I-N, right?
Sure.
So here we're seeing something extremely important, because remember, skeptics and scientists can go and study this. Check out that these families were talking about where their land is.
Mm.
And that just happened to be out of the blue, right? Where the gold is and where the wealth is. Yeah. And why Rome would be interested in this. Dunford says that according to ancient tradition, a relative of King Metellanus, who was known as Mansutius, founded a monastic seat of learning during the first century AD at a place called Dull, D-U-L-L, a few miles from Fortingall. So it's the Dull area, Fortingall area, that we're specifically talking about. Now, he says that at Dull was a monastery of such importance and such proportions, it was awarded the unusual title of Abthanedum, right? Abthanedum. This is a title that's given. The monastery or abbey of Dull was of such great importance that tradition avers that it was the first seat of learning in Scotland. Exactly how this monastery and place of learning came to be situated in the Vale of Menzies is not known, but two traditions are connected with this initiation. The most recent refers to a Saint Adamnan, who lived and preached at Glen Leon in the latter half of the 7th century.
Mm-hmm.
But an even older legend, recorded by the Scottish chroniclers, attributes this inauguration of the College of Learning to this Mensutius in the 1st century AD. Mensutius was the son and near relation, as we said, of King Metellanus, and he went to Rome.
Hmm.
Right? So this son of Metellanus goes to Rome. In Rome, he witnessed the preaching of the Apostle Peter.
Right.
Here's the cover story again, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's always about you bump into the apostle.
Sure.
What it means is you bumped into the, you took a walk up to the palace of the British and hobnobbed with the Atenists. They're not going to tell you that. So they say, oh, he just happened to hear St. Peter, you know, with his crow's ear, you know?
Sure.
Whatever. You want to believe that? That's fine. So he goes to Rome, and he gets converted to the teachings of Christ, and he's ordained as a disciple.
Hmm.
Again, the fake story to try and say, I had to go to the East to be converted to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
We're not the founders of Christianity. We didn't invent it in Britain. No, no, no. We just happened to be on holiday one day, walking around in the streets of Rome, and got converted. And then old Peter says, why don't you go back to Scotland and open a monastery?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
Good idea. I'll hasten off and do just that. And every Christian is going to now accept this.
Yeah.
No question of the power dynamics, you see, and the mercantile trading that's going on, right?
Sure.
It's all holy. It's all religious.
Mm.
So these crooks, and believe me, the people who are the cardinals and the propaganda duet, P2,
mm-hmm.
right, and the
yeah.
whole host of the Club of Rome, you think they're doing anything different to this day?
Nope.
Certainly the monastery of Dol, you see, owned large areas of rich land, which this so-called Saint Adamnan would not have had access to, but which could well have been the original heritage of Mensutius.
Hmm.
So another point. Do you conceive of the amount of wealth we're talking about here?
No, I do not, frankly, no.
Right. Templar wealth, as I've got in my chapter on the Templars in the book, will let you know that when you hear these little anecdotes about, oh, the Templars were the first bankers of Europe, you know, etc., and they had
how
a lot
come?
Of money,
how
treasures.
Come?
How come? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that when they were purged in France, they ended up in Scotland. These are the same people who are in control today because these were the people who built the cities of the world.
Mm-hmm.
They built not only the monasteries, they not only built Rome, they not only built Edinburgh. You know, we're talking about the builders of our Christian civilization.
The universities,
the banks, the
yeah.
historical institutes,
sure.
the lot. These are the characters we're talking about.
And I guess you also have the, okay, a lot of money, a lot of gold, silver, and so forth, but also for other kind of resources we can start to industrialize and, you know, technology, high technology,
yes.
as a consequence of this.
And if you go to these modern technological institutes, and I don't care how shiny and gorgeous they look in the cities, you will always find the royal insignias in the architecture.
Mm.
You'll always find some weird Masonic stuff or a bizarre sculpture. That you, of course, as a student, won't have the faintest idea what that means. Start checking into it.
Mm.
Start finding out what these symbols in the cities mean, why, what they're related to. I found that quote by Dunford about the connection to France, just for people who think we're making this up. In a book, but Dunford says that in the book, The Coming of the Saints, published in 1906, the author John W. Taylor says, Mansutius then becomes called Saint Mansu.
Hmm.
He's now a saint. They canonize him overnight.
Mm-hmm.
We have enough bucks, you know, enough money. So now Mansutius of the Royal Houses of Scotland suddenly becomes Saint Mansui.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right? An Irish or Caledonian Briton. Mm-hmm. Caledonian just simply means Scotland, for those who don't know. It's
mm-hmm.
the old name for Scotland. He's an old Irish and Caledonian Briton, became the Bishop of Toul in Lorraine.
Right. Okay.
In AD 89.
Mm.
All right, so we're talking about the same Champagne, same Burgundian
mm-hmm.
Templar families.
Sure.
Coming out of France. That's why you see the fleur-de-lis, so many on Scottish flags.
Okay. See?
There's the whole mm-hmm. Scottish tie-in,
sure.
you know.
Sure.
We go into this in the work, showing how all the kings are descended from these characters we're talking about.
Yeah.
That's how you become a king. Kings are rich. Kings are related to these dynastic families. Kings have said the right things
mm-hmm.
theologically.
Mm.
Right? They, you know, they go on indoctrinating. He says that Mansutius, he says, was a constant visitor to the palace of the British at Rome after Claudia had married Pudens.
Okay.
And I said Rufus Pudens, the centurion, is mentioned by St. Paul in the Bible, no less.
Mm.
He was a friend of Linus, the first bishop of Rome.
The first bishop.
The first bishop of Rome.
Okay.
We're not talking about years down the line, centuries, decades. Or the first bishop of Rome is a pal with all of these guys.
There we go.
Right. This is the connection that, you know, and when you see the Egyptian imagery, not only of Rome itself, when you take into the fact that Rome is aligned to the ancient Celtic, the ancient Irish sites of Nowth and Newgrange, to the Sun Doors, no less, right? You understand that this is the Egyptian connection, the Atenists. Because there's only one people who have this connection between Ireland and Egypt and Rome. Now he says that this happened. Now he says, after the death of St. Clemens, Mansutius became the first official bishop of the British Church at Rome. What a character. He's bishop down in Toul in Lorraine. He's pals with the first bishop of Rome. And bishop of Rome means Pope of Rome, by the way, just in case people don't understand what that means.
Okay.
The bishop of Rome is the Pope.
Okay.
Right? And he's made, after the death of the first saint, you know, like St. Patrick's era, because this is all happening around the time of St. Patrick also. Let's not forget that.
Okay.
This is all happening in the first wave of saints, so-called. But after the death of St. Clemens, who was the first, who was appointed for England, it's this Mansutius of the House of Menzies who becomes the Bishop of Rome, the Bishop of the British Church of Rome.
Wow. Yeah. How about that?
Elites. Elites.
There's a clear connection, again, between all of these, the areas, the families, and the timeline, even, when all of this starts springing up. You know,
the symbolism.
Sure.
The Egyptian symbolism. We wish we had time more to go in it. We mentioned a few of there that the stones of Ireland are covered in Atenistic symbolism. Yep. It's proving that they got there. The proof has now come to light. You know, that I'm collating all of this work because people don't have, you know, 3 centuries to research all this.
That's right, exactly.
So I'm stuck. You know, we have to, I very sincerely believe that scholars of this age, especially in alternative history, have a job as collators to synthesize.
Sure.
So that you can synthesize lots of information for people to get it in very quick time.
Absolutely.
You can get it in matters
of
days. You read a chapter, it'll only take a couple of days. You're going to get centuries of understanding. This is crucially important. It's not just to keep on beating to death one area, you see.
Sure.
We need to look at things synthetically now. Who were these Romans? Maybe we've been told a pack of lies. Who were these, you know, Chaldeans? Who the hell are these Cistercians that had these salt lines and ley lines all marked out?
Sure.
Who had the audacity to build their temples over ancient sites? In fact, you see, when you really take it down into the deepest level, what we have to understand is, as we said, you can't molest the sacred sites unless you turn it, not from a business, but it has to be a religion. This goes to the full extent of creating. You also need to account for the reason why you've plagiarized the ancient canon of the Druids. Within the canon of the Druids was a famous god called Issa.
Issa. You mentioned that.
Or Ayasa, right? In fact, in Aramaic, the word for Jesus is Issa. In India, they still call Jesus Issa.
Really?
Yeah, Ayasa. And even in the Quran, he's known as this. But Ayasa is a god known thousands of years before Christianity was ever born. Ayasa was known thousands of years before Atenism was ever born. Okay? This is one of the most important gods of the ancient Druids. What better than to create your Christianity, to fabricate this god? And as Jordan Maxwell has also shown, there is no historicity to Jesus. People should understand this now, because it is absolutely understood that all the events that happen around Jesus are astrotheological in nature. You have this component in the Bible that St. Paul was basically plagiarizing all the old astrostellar symbolism. How can that be a biography? Nazareth has never been discovered. They've even found that it doesn't exist.
Really?
It was never a place. None of the events or the circumstances or the topography of the Far East matches. So when people like Commons Beaumont come along to tell you that all the things in the Bible actually are things and events that took place in Britain, now we can understand what he's talking about. It was transplanted over there. Because, again, you have to have the creation of a Jesus, a Christ, be far away from Druidic lands.
Look over there. Not here. This land,
That's right. And, of course, they don't mind. Like I said, remember there's 2 strains of Christianity, the esoteric.
Sure.
Under which comes the Templars, the Cathars,
the
Bogomils, the Essenes, yes. And then the Orthodox. The steering committee doesn't care if Orthodox Christians forever to the day they die believe that Jesus came out of Palestine, what's said in the Bible. If you want to believe that, they're happy. They know that the esoteric groups, these Templar elites, you see, these nobles, they know the truth. But it's okay if you don't know it.
Hmm.
They don't mind.
Yeah.
If you live in ignorance of it all.
Sure, sure.
So he says here that one great, great quote from Reverend C.C. Dobson. He says that the more Druidism is studied, the more apparent it is its relationship to the revealed religion of Mosaic law.
Hmm.
Here's a guy who's a reverend who's touching upon it.
Mm-hmm.
He's studied both sides, and he's starting to weigh. He goes, look, this whole Judaic Mosaic thing, man, it looks so much like Druidism. These Essenes, it looks like a bunch of Druids.
Mm.
That's right, because the Druidic teachings had been in Egypt thousands of years before Atenism was even heard of.
Mm-hmm.
All of it was a warped version of Druidism.
Sure.
Dudley Wright, in a book called Druidism, the Ancient Faith of Britain, which is absolutely unavailable. A lot of the books we're quoting from, by the way, are very hard to find, especially this one.
Mm.
Right? Dudley Wright, he says, the fact must not be overlooked when speaking of the supplanting of Druidism by Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
That the Druids held many tenets inculcated in Christianity and the practice and customs of the Christians. The doctrine of the immortality of the soul, the belief in miracles, the doctrine of reincarnation, all of this in those days, articles of the Christian faith. Right? As we know, in early days of Christianity, right? They believed in reincarnation.
The more Gnostic.
Yeah, in the
version.
Early days.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, it was official. He says all of this had already been imparted to the Britons by their own priests.
Hmm. Sheesh.
I go further. I say there's not a thing in any of Judeo-Christianity that's not born out of Druidism.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's warped. Don't believe the apologists. Don't believe the propagandists who say it's a seamless evolution of Druidism. The Druids would have been jumping with joy. No, they were put in the flames and were hacked to pieces because they wouldn't buy into this.
Mm.
They knew who you were. Quote from George Jowett again. He says, the astounding fact is that whereas the Sadducean Judeans were never familiar with the name of the Messiah, his name was known to the British long before the memorable event transpired on Golgotha Hill.
There we go.
Right? It was a name familiar on the lips of every Briton. The indisputable fact is that the Druids proclaimed the name first to the world. How the Druidic priesthood, now here's the classic line, how the Druidic priesthood knew the consecrated name so long beforehand is indeed a mystery in itself. The name Yasu was incorporated in the Druidic Trinity as Godhead.
Huh.
It's no mystery.
No,
there's that word
not.
Again.
Yeah.
Mystery. It's a mystery. It's only a mystery if you're a Christian reading Christian books indoctrinated by Christianity.
They remote viewed it, you see.
That's right. Same thing is brought up by the incredible researcher that my book is dedicated to, Commons Beaumont, the Scottish researcher, English researcher who had studied all of Scottish history and world history. He said that as far back as 1640, the German traveler Kort, after a complete topographical examination of the present Jerusalem, decided that it failed to coincide in any way with the city described by Josephus and the scriptures. Did you know that Ralph Ellis is absolutely convinced that this so-called Josephus, the famous Jewish historian, was none other than St. Paul?
Really?
Yeah, so this quote will make more sense when you buy into the latest researches of people like this magnificent writer, Ralph Ellis, who is convinced that Josephus, the famous historian of the Jews, who's, you know, we turn to his writings about
sure,
the middle.
Yeah,
he's none other
story.
But the same propagandist St. Paul we're talking about,
who's
sitting there being schooled by the British.
Sure.
This what to write.
That would turn things on the head, wouldn't
right.
it? You know?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So he says here, Beaumont goes on to say, that it fails to coincide in any way with the city described by Josephus and the scriptures. Claims that the tomb of patriarchs Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are buried under the mosque in Hebron possess no shred of evidence. The rock-cut sepulchres in the valleys of Jehoshaphat and Hinnom are of Roman period and late Greek inscriptions, and there exists nothing in groups of ruins in Petra, in Sebaste, in Baalbek, Palmyra, or Damascus, or among the stone cities of Haran that are pre-Roman. Right, it's very new. Nothing in Jerusalem itself can ever be related to the Jews. Dobson goes on to say, the basic Druidic belief was in a trinity, Henrik, right? You only have to go to their monuments to see it.
Sure.
The Godhead was called Dua, D-U-W, like where we get our word Deus. Right?
Okay, yeah.
Or a day, even. Du, from which we get the word Jupiter, Jew. See, the D was pronounced J in some countries, so Jeu or Deu, right? So the Godhead was called Deu, or Du, the one without darkness who pervaded the universe.
Hmm.
Then three golden rays of light were the emblem of Druidism. Right? That's Kabbalah, by the way. Three rays of light is the three pillars of the Kabbalah going down from Godhead,
okay.
Which everyone thinks is Jewish. Total lie, right? It's Egyptian Druidic is what it is. So three golden rays of light were the emblem of Druidism, representing the three aspects or persons of the Trinity emanating from that Godhead. And they were known as Bel, the creator god of the past, Taran, the controlling providence of the present, and Esu, or Yesu, the coming savior.
The Holy Trinity, right there. Yeah.
But they describe Yesu very clearly as the coming savior in the future.
Okay.
He's always described that way. And he's a sacrificial god. He has his side pierced with a sharp instrument, and his blood flows into the earth. And he's always shown that his blood is sacrifice because the earth needs his blood to be reborn. This is what the Druids always showed. And Yesu, the rite of Yesu, during the time when his rites were being done, they'd always chop a tree, all its branches off, and make a tree that had a cross shape.
More like an X?
Like an X or just like a T.
Okay, okay. Right?
And on the T part, they'd write the word Jesus. H-E-S-U-S or Iesa, right? And they'd often show... Iesa would be hung in the air like he's on nothing. Sometimes he was even shown in a cruciform with his hands outstretched, you know, like the cross, but on nothing, just with the sun behind his head, giving his blood sacrifice. He was a sacrificial god. And he says that Druidism thus anticipated Christianity and pointed to the coming savior under the very name which Christ was called. J.R.S. Mead, one of the greatest theosophists, he wrote a book called Did Jesus Live 100 B.C. It's a crucial book to have. I think you can read it free online. He says, we know further from several sources that the Christians were originally called Galileans. Gale, Scythian, Atnest, Irish, right? Galilean. It is said that Julian the Emperor desired to have them so called. And in his own writings, he invariably refers to them under this designation. Justin Martyr knows of pre-Christian sect called Galileans. Pre-Christian, that's very important. Because that's what we're talking about. Epictetus, another historian, who died in 117 AD, calls the Christians Galileans. Mani, in the 3rd century, calls the general Christians Galileans. They weren't called Christians. Christianity was already in the world. It was already Essenes, who predate Christians. A group called the Therapeutae, which we don't have time to cover. Therapeutes were pre-Christians. Now he's talking about Galileans from Galilee. People who've really done their homework with Christianity know that Jesus' mission was really in Galilee, not Judea. That three books of the Bible, the three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, always say that he was in Galilee. It's only John who starts talking about Judea.
Okay.
The fact is that it was all happening in Galilee. They were all Gentiles in Galilee, not Jews in Judea. There's another lie right there within the Gospels. So I believe this is all transplanted. These are all Atenists setting up shop in Palestine so that they can talk about Iesa without you being too close to home.
I see.
They're creating a religion. And they're creating a religion there because King Metellanus is sitting on his ass on top of all that money thinking, how the hell are we going to territorialize this place?
Yeah, exactly. Keep this.
Yeah,
and
we're going to have armed peasants coming down with clubs going, get off these ancient sites.
Sure.
We may not like them, but look, these are our sacred heritage. These are strategists. These are people who know how the game of colonization is played. Mead goes on to say that for a short time, the Christians also called themselves, and get this, Jesseans. Jesse. Like Jesse.
Sure.
Jesseans. He says that now it is well known that the name Essene is one of the greatest puzzles of scholarship. Upwards of 20 derivations have been given by ancient and modern writers, and the riddle still remains unsolved. Well, it's just been solved.
Yeah, yeah.
The Essenes were not even aware of Jesus' existence, okay? They barely write about the guy.
Okay.
They are coming from... People have no idea where these guys came from. They can't link them to the Jews, although that's been done, but that breaks down, you see? Every new discovery that's made makes it more elusive. It isn't elusive when you understand that the Sadducees, the Israelites, the Jews, all these people that you're referring to as Judeans... These people that you're referring to as Christians basically are, as we said at the beginning of the show, Atenists. It all has the root of the mother of Atenism. Because as Ralph Ellis has shown, these Israelites are the Hyksos pharaohs of Egypt. He's not the first to show it. Beaumont already knew it. Velikovsky speculated on it. Sigmund Freud knew about it. Do you know how many authors in the past went into this that never anybody read? It's taken till our modern times now for this fact to come out again.
Mm.
Once you realize these connections, you have no problem understanding that Atenism controlled a lot of them.
Hmm.
Atenism was behind most of these groups. It was behind Mithraism. It was behind the Zoroastrianism. They're all hybrids. They're all worshipping the sun in one way or another.
Monotheistic.
Sure. Mm. They're the monotheism. And that type of monotheism, especially that warped, patriarchal, masculinized, highly exclusive, you see, and very almost puritanical, tyrannical form of sun worship is the child of Atenism, which spread throughout the world. And Dunford goes on here to say something incredible. He says that there is certainly reason to suppose that the family of Jesus may have been related to the Celto-British royal family of the time.
Hmm.
So he's saying, look, if there is a character, even if there was a man out there in Palestine, he's related to these British royal families. I believe there was a man. Ralph Ellis has taken it back to a guy called Jesus of Gamala.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus of Gamala is actually related to the Roman houses.
All right.
He was a son of Cleopatra and one of the Roman pharaohs, Roman Caesars, I think Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
I'd have to look at my notes. But as far as I can remember, Ralph Ellis has taken, he is the closest person, and he's not a British Israelite, so he's not contaminated by all this, did he go to England bit, which is very spurious, right? Because, you know, if you believe Christ went to Europe, from the information I'm giving you, you can equally discern that he left Britain to go to Palestine.
Yeah.
I mean, once you're into British Israelitism, it works both ways.
Sure.
Joseph of Arimathea brings a child, Christ, to the Holy Land, you know, of England. Well, wait a minute. The half of the British Israelites believe now that, no, he was born there and was transplanted over to Palestine. But if you leave the British Israelite ideology behind, then you follow these other authors who are trying to, you know, pinpoint who was the closest approximation to the man known as Jesus. Not the Christ that Paul created, who's a god.
But the real man.
A man, a revolutionary, maybe a messianic character. Well, there's lots of them, and I have them all listed in the book. In book two of Irish Origins, we list all the main, you know, protagonists.
Interesting.
Out of Judaism, out of Gentilism, you see. Some of them incredible characters.
That are possibly
were based on Christ.
Jesus, okay.
On the Jesus, sorry. And one of them was a most interesting character, is actually by the name of Apollonius of Tyana.
Mm-hmm.
But another fascinating character who's really interesting life story is Jesus of Gamala, which was a region, you see, in Palestinian, in Judean era. And Ralph Ellis is the expert on that. People need to pick up his books and look into this to find this out. So there may have been, just like they borrowed all the astrotheology, just like Paul, right? Used the archive, the canon of astrology to create his 12 disciples and his whole little mythos of Jesus. So these Atenists may have also borrowed from a lot of other histories. But you see, as Beaumont and so many people have pointed out, there's a problem. By displacing their Christianity and their Jesus to the foreign eastern shores, they also made a mistake. They knew too little about those areas. By knowing too little about those areas, they left a lot of glitches. Because they know nothing about the Palestinians. The Palestinians are never mentioned or described in the Bible.
Really?
Yeah. The topography of the area is a total bogus. I mean, they can't dig up anything that ever, you know, corresponds, because believe me, if they could, they would. You'd be hearing about it from morning to night. The fact that you don't hear about them finding anything is because there's nothing there to find, as these authors say. It's limited. And I have an entire part of the book two of the Irish Origins called Did Israel Exist? I want people to go and read that. Refer to the works of Professor Thompson. You know, we'll put up links. Thomas L. Thompson. Incredible thesis showing that, you know, it's a complete lie, just like Beaumont and all of these people knew, that this ancient history has been concocted. Most of Christian history has been concocted. And this was the mistake. For ideological and political reasons, they had to situate Christianity in Rome and further afield. Because Rome is nicely placed, is it not, between the Eastern world and Western. That double-headed eagle of control can operate from Rome. Two empires, East and West. You keep a handle on your enemies, right? To be near ports of the Mediterranean.
Exactly.
What good is out there in northern Scotland going to do you? That's your garden retreat. You got to run the trade lines of Mesopotamia. I mean, if you don't do it, your rivals are going to start doing it. Right? So you're into business. You're into felling trees and starting the whole shebang going, you see. And to do that, you need to be near the places where the spices are grown, where the minerals can be sold, all of that. They're very clever.
And this is a natural step in a global empire, that you have different centers for different purposes, you know.
That's right. And although we don't have time to go into it, one of the other big loopholes that prove everything that I'm talking about is the similarity between what people think of as Hebrew and Gaelic. another loophole, if we, it would take a whole other show to explore this, is the amazing connections between the Hebrew language, which is nothing but Phoenician, by the way. The Phoenicians tie into all of this. The word Phoenician actually means men who are red, red men. And one of the reasons why they were called red is because that's what a white man's skin turns when you're burning up in the Mediterranean.
And an Irishman, yeah.
An Irishman or Nordic men, right? Long blonde hair, huge blonde beards, piercing blue eyes, and burning red skin. You look like a god, right? When your ship's pulled up. And these characters turn up in the Middle East. They really look special. Plus, they also wore copper because they were copper miners. So their bracelets, jewelry, and necklaces were made of bright red copper, shining like the sun. They made a really incredible, you know, appearance. They were expert in wood. They were high astrologers. They're navigators. They told all the stories. You know, they were conquerors. They were the giants. The Phoenicians were the giants. They also are responsible for dyeing cloth and beautiful hues. You know, they're responsible, mythology says, for building the Temple of Solomon. You know, I mean, there's a whole tradition of the Phoenicians. So old Hebrew, which is not what Jews speak today, by the way, Yiddish and modern Hebrew are what's called classical languages, just like Latin and Greek. They're not in any way related to what the Bible talks about as ancient Hebrew.
Okay.
Ancient Hebrew is more connected to Aramaic.
Yeah.
And it's also connected to Phoenician. It is Phoenician. But the red men were from the West. The closest language, parent language to Gaelic, to Hebrew is Gaelic. Even Welsh. And you know something? Even Cornish, the language of Cornwall, is indistinguishable in its syntax and its lettering.
Really?
You know, to Hebrew, to the ancient Hebrew.
That's
another cover-up.
Yeah.
Proving these connections between the British Isles, the Gaelic, the kings, you know, the kings, and the Eastern setup. But it's not that the Scythians brought that language. They also spoke it and were experts. The Scythians themselves had colleges all over the world in the later days. But my work is to show you that even before the Scythians, even before the Gaels, even before the Celts, even before Atenism, the Druids were there. They were already spreading these languages. Of course, languages changed a little bit depending on the region. The dialect changes or the syntax may change. But the essence of the languages are originally from Gaelic, what ancient Gaelic is, which is why Christianity declared war on the Gaelic language, as we said in previous shows.
Again, sir, I mean, there's so much in this book you can, you know.
Well, it's all there. We're just
exactly, and so many things that we, you know, didn't have time to get to, you know, in this show. But
right.
that is why people need to, you know, get the book and read it for themselves, you know, and they need to explore these areas. And again, this is, as we pointed out in this show, that this is stuff that is connected with things that are going on today. This is a history, and it's a timeline behind this.
Well, see, the main idea is to realize that this is not ancient history. This connects with what's happening in the world today. Because the founders of these monarchies are still in existence, in one way or another. It wouldn't mean a thing if it was just a matter of a benign, you know, changeover in religion or whatever. The people that we're talking about who desecrated Ireland, who obliterated this ancient tradition, who destroyed the colleges of the elders, they took that knowledge and are using it today.
Yep.
These same Knights Templars, who were just a stone's throw ago, were behind the Bourbons, the Guise family, the Savoys, the Saxe Coburg Gothas, all the people you think, you know, people who don't think matter, the Habsburgs, the Hanoverans, the people behind Russell Trust, the people behind Skull and Bones, the people behind the secret societies, the Freemasons, the Templars, Propaganda Due. These are created by these same core families that we're talking about. Ancient crimes, modern times. Rome. And see, why it's very important is, you see, tomorrow they may be planning something to throw up in your face that you're not going to understand what it is unless you know what they're, how these people have operated from day one.
That's a possibility.
What happens if they concoct another Messiah tomorrow?
Yeah.
What happens if they exonerate all these secret societies and start, and all mankind turns around and goes, okay, we accept that these were the forefathers of civilization. That they've actually been hidden, granted, but that's because they were being persecuted. And don't forget that after AD, after the crucifixion, I'm not denying that these groups then went on to have tremendous infighting.
Sure.
We're talking about Diocletian, the pagan, goes and massacres. And we have subsequent massacres within Christianity. Constantine murdering a lot of people, including his own wife. And then we have the Templars being suppressed, right? We have the Albigensian Crusade, in which the Pope declares war, see, and murders, puts all these people in the flames. We have Montesigur, the destruction of the Cathars. But to me, that's all really to be taken with a pinch of salt. I don't really care if Frank Nitti, the enforcer, is now fighting Al Capone.
See what you mean.
If Tweedledum is bashing Tweedledee in this Punch and Judy show that's been set up so that your eyes are on the stage show that they have created. They're all atonists. Mm-hmm. They're all Christians. Now that they own the world and they've murdered everybody that was true and sacred and pure, now that they've butchered witches and massacred the women of the world and own all of these lands, oh, don't you think that these pathological, insane megalomaniacs are going to eventually start turning on each other and going, no, that's mine, that belongs to me, no, that's a bit of mine, and pulling and tearing at each other?
Yeah.
That's only to be expected.
Of course.
But I don't worry about it. I am thinking of the bigger crime that these people, you know, are guilty of.
So when
one pope is clubbing another pope and, you know, all these wars, 100 years war, 30 years war, to me it's like, okay, whatever, you know, they're already guilty of unimaginable crimes. Now they start turning on themselves.
Sure.
What of it?
Yeah.
They're all hyenas anyway. And you need to know that because you ain't going to make sense of any of these rivalries that history puts in front of you or that your history teachers put in front of you. You're never going to work it out. Because what is the consequence of not knowing what I've just said? You identify.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I'm for that esoteric group. Hey, I'm really into that. No, I'm an Orthodox Christian, and we should have it this way. I'm a Protestant. No, I'm a Catholic. No, I favor the Templars. No, I don't. If you side with any of these groups, no, I'm for William the Conqueror. No, I'm a Saxon. No, I'm an Angle. I'm a Jute. We have to have it this way. I'm an Irish Catholic. No, I'm an Irish Protestant. You know, I'm a black Jew from Africa. We're elite. No, I'm a Khazar Jew. No, I'm Ashkenaz. If you believe in all of these divisions and think that they're real and that they're legitimate, you side with these groups.
Sure, you're in the game.
You're playing the game.
Sure.
And you're allowing this horrible edifice to continue. And why are you doing it? Is because you think, look, if we can only get this gang out, our gang will be in and the world will be living in harmony.
Mm-hmm.
How much more atrocity do we have before we realize that if that gang leaves and this gang comes in, nothing changes. Nothing ever has changed.
Yeah.
That's my point. They're all the same gang.
Mm.
We even know that the Stuarts are related to the House of Orange.
Mm.
The greatest conflicts in the world have been by related families. The British Windsors are connected to the Kaiser.
The War of the Roses
That. The War of the Roses is a perfect example.
Sure.
The Russians and the Germans, incredible wars between each other. The royal families are connected by blood.
Sure.
Then we get into the Rothschild connection. I mean, the whole point is that they're all one big pathological, psychopathic group who need to be confronted, like I said in the beginning, the light of that they seem to love so much. Let's see how much they love it when it's shining in their eyes, when their skeletons are uncovered. Now is our time. Now is the time to learn this. That's what my work is, you know, motivated by, in short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a fascinating subject. It's fascinating history.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. Me and Michael, we're fast running out of time here, but again, tell people that are interested in getting the book how they most, you know, easily would go about doing that.
Well, it's at the printers now. So the update is that it's at the printers. It'll be ready in a very, very short time, certainly before Christmas. And they can go to IrishOriginsOfCivilization.com and purchase it there. You know, there's also, I've decided to put the appendices of the book, which is quite substantial. In the end, the appendices are going to become thicker than the book itself because it's a lot of collaborative stuff that I'm being sent from around the world.
Mm.
That's free and online on the same website. We have lots of stuff there on the Minoans, the Cretans, the discoveries of, you know, like I said, these other authors who've revealed amazing things about the Templars. And I just want to personally thank you, Henrik, for, you know, allowing me this time, this particular series of shows, so that we can preview the book and get into some of the areas that I think are personally very important that, you know, people who read the book may not realize this is essential.
Yeah.
These shows have helped to isolate that and bring out these classically, to me, crucial themes, you know, like the British Israelite.
Absolutely.
Concept, the fact of the corruption of the word Arya, the terrible, terrible corruption that's been done with that word. The idea of the East to West movement or the West to East movement, which, you know, I'm trying to blow holes in the East to West movement. But, you know, you can't just say that without proving it.
Sure.
Let's establish what you mean by that. You know, so you've given me the opportunity to do that. We've gone into the whole question of the land bridges.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the areas that I want people to really focus on. And also how these secret societies are connected. And the most important thing, which is the real essence, is that now, when people are looking at the pyramid and being told to look at all these secret society symbolisms, they're not going to make the fundamental mistake of going, oh, there you are, it's Zionist, it's Jewish, it's royal, it's you know, all of this that's happening. People who have a little piece of it and then run with it, and they may be wrong. We've got to go further than that. It's not just as simple as being Masonic, you see, or Rosicrucian. You know, don't stop there.
Yeah.
Track this back and find out where's its real origin.
That's right.
And this is what I'm so happy to have been able to achieve, because it was a daunting task. There's so many threads to pull together. You know, it seemed like I was very much guided. So I can say that it was a joy to do it, because I felt guided. I learned a lot in the process, you know. And now we're at the printing stage, and people can benefit from this knowledge. And your show's, again, you know, totally indebted to you for helping with that process.
It's been great doing it. I mean, again, thank you so much for, you know, picking out the information and getting the information to us. And again, I'm looking forward to very much diving into the book itself, you know, because it's going to be great to see it. So again, I recommend everyone to head on over right away to IrishOriginsOfCivilization.com. And as you said, Michael, do check out those appendices. There's some amazing stuff there already, you know, and as you said, that's going to grow.
It's constantly updated.
Yeah.
It's constantly updated.
And also, of course, the main website for Michael is michaeltessarion.com, so do check out that. And again, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for doing these programs with us, Michael.
Oh, you're welcome, Hendrik. Thank you very much.
And I want to thank everyone also for tuning into the program, of course, and big thanks to Fredrik in the control room. Red X Creations will be back again on Thursday. Until then, take good care, everyone. Bye.